Okay, so let's get started. I sent out a sample midterm exam and solutions from a prior edition. So use that as a guideline for the upcoming midterm that's going to be on Tuesday. Tuesday there is no class, okay? There's just going to be an evening exam. So class is cancelled for the day. So the couple of quick points regarding the exam. What I would recommend you do, again just a reminder that only lectures 1 through 13 are on the test. Okay, I've mentioned this several times already. So don't worry about anything that we have covered since lecture 13. So use those lectures. The way I would go about studying for the exam, or the way I recommend you do this, is start with the lecture notes. Okay. Make sure you understand what is on the lecture slides. And only that material that's related to it, which is in the book, is what you should look at. The book probably has, every chapter has more material than we have covered. You don't need to worry about that. Focus on the stuff that we have actually covered in class. Okay? So make sure you understand everything on the lecture slides. So that, I think, is basically what is the material I will have assumed we covered in class. Okay? Don't just start reading book, the book, and just start reading pages and pages of stuff that we have not covered. That will be a waste of your time. Okay, so use the lecture slides as a way to figure out what material to use from the book, and especially make sure what's on the notes is understood. Okay, that's basically what I would do. I did hand out some extra material last time, or maybe it was 2-3 classes back. Some of you have not picked it up, so I brought it back. Because the midterm is coming up. So if you hadn't picked these two handouts, pick one up before you leave. Okay? So between the book, this material, and the lecture notes, you should basically have everything you need for the midterm. Okay? I'm here for questions today, tomorrow. I'm not here on Monday. Okay, so if you have last minute questions, I can handle them by email, but I won't be here in person to answer those. Any questions about the exam? It is going to be in the next room. Okay, the room adjacent to it at 6. Okay, so I had mentioned that we will start at 6. So it's an evening exam. Any other logistics questions? Yes, you have a question there.
Some obscure item in the book that was never covered in the lecture notes is not.
Okay. Don't worry about it. It's not part of the course. Okay, so I mean, as I said, start with the lecture note. For every lecture, just look at the notes first, understand that, go to the book, review that material, and then that will enhance your understanding. Any other questions? The exam? Okay. So let's continue our discussion on security. So last time we talked about why security is important in distributed systems. We basically looked at encryption. Okay, said security has multiple facets. There's encryption, there's authentication, there's auditing and forensics. So we have already covered the encryption part of it. We looked at symmetric encryption algorithms like DES, and we looked at asymmetric algorithms which fall under the category of public key cryptography. So we looked at RSA, problems with RSA, and so on. So with that background, today we are going to do authentication. And there are multiple ways of doing authentication, and we'll look at. And here is a slide that tries to motivate why you need to do authentication. Okay, and to understand, so first you need to prove your identity to the system, or two entities need to prove their identities to one another for secure communication to occur. Yeah, that's one thing. The second thing is, depending on who you are, you may have certain privileges or rights in the system. So you need to tell the system who you are, and you shouldn't let other people masquerade as you. Okay? And then once the system knows who you are, then you are basically granted certain privileges or rights in the system, and that is checked. So what this thing is showing is, where is the check happening? So here you could actually invoke certain methods on object. This could be, you're accessing a file, you're accessing an object in memory, and so on. And at that point you check what rights you are given. Okay, and then you are allowed or not allowed to perform that operation. Okay. Here you are basically checking before you actually go to the object. You are basically asking this person to provide you some proof that you have access to the object, and only then you are even allowed to access that object. Okay. So first is you are basically protecting it against invalid operation. That's the first one. Second one, you are protecting as an unauthorized invocation. So you are not even allowed to invoke the method if you don't have the rights to do that. And related to that is the issue of protection against unauthorized user. So you want, in a distributed system, you want to protect against invalid operations, the operations that may not make sense for this object. You may want to protect against unauthorized operations. Somebody who's not may not have administrative privileges shouldn't be allowed to do certain things on a machine, for instance. And there may be unauthorized users. Users are not even allowed to access this machine. So you want to do all of that, and the common technique that is used to do all of this is authentication, okay, which we are going to look at. So the basic problem that we want to address in authentication is, how does a receiver know that the remotely communicating entity is who they claim to be? Okay. So you want to figure this out. So if just somebody just tells you, let's say somebody calls you on the phone and says, I am your bank. Okay. There's no way for you to know without any extra information whether that's the person actually represents who they are claiming to represent. So you need something more to figure this out. Okay. So we'll look at an authentication protocol that allows us to do this. So we'll go through a sequence of these protocols, and we'll see that there are some problems with the way things are done now. So we'll keep enhancing it until we get a correct authentication protocol. So the what I showed on the previous slide is just Alice sending a message to Bob claiming I'm Alice. There's somebody calls you on the phone and say they represent your bank or they represent some organization. You don't really know whether that's right or not. So in other words, an intruder can also do the same thing and pretend to be Alice, for instance. Okay? So there's no way to figure that out. So if this is a machine, you might say, let us actually check the IP address of where this message came from, and if the IP address is valid and you know that it belongs to Alice, for instance, then we can assume that the message actually came from so this is another way of doing authentication based on IP address. Okay, now the problem here is you can also do IP address spoofing. It is relatively simple for you to inject a message into the network with an incorrect source IP address. Okay, so when it reaches the other end, there's no guarantee that the message actually originated from the machine that has the IP address on the packet. Okay, so this is not going to, these simple things don't work, is basically the point. Okay? So the typical solution is that you use a secret password. You say, I'm Alice, and you provide a secret password, and you can check the authenticity of the password, and if you know that the password matches, then you know it must be Alice because it's secret and nobody else knows this. So the simple protocol is, I am Alice, here is my password. Okay. Now the problem, that this is a fine authentication protocol. The problem with the protocol is, if you actually send the password in plain text over a network, then this packet is vulnerable to being captured by an intruder. Okay, so for instance, a protocol like Telnet that used for remote login actually sends your username and password in plain text over the network, unencrypted. Okay, so if this packet is captured by someone else on the network by sniffing packets, for instance, your username and password is revealed to this person. Okay, so although your password is secret, you are not sending it in a secure fashion when you are trying to do authentication. So the technique itself of using a secret password is fine. The way you are doing the authentication by sending this password without on an unsecure channel in plain text is the problem. And so this suggests that somehow you should encrypt all of the messages in addition to having a shared in addition to having a password. So one way to do this is use simple encryption. So if you use symmetric key encryption algorithms, you can pick up key that is only known to Alice and Bob. Okay, in this case, Alice may be a person and Bob may be a machine, or Alice and Bob can both be programs, it doesn't matter. But you can just use a secret key that only these two parties know, and this is chosen ahead of time. Okay. So now when Alice sends a message to Bob saying, I am Alice, you encrypt that message with the secret key. Okay. And you send this message over a network. Okay. And then if Bob, once Bob gets this message, Bob will decrypt the message using that same secret key, and if the message content say I am Alice, then then you can be sure that only Alice could have sent this message. Okay, the reason being, the key is only known to Alice and Bob, and if an encrypted message arrives, that decrypts and it says I'm Alice, you can assume that it actually came from Alice. Okay. Now the so this is again a protocol. As a protocol, this is fine. Okay. But the problem with this is it is vulnerable to what is called a playback attack. Okay. So an intruder in particular can capture this encrypted packet, okay, store it, and at some later point actually present this encrypted packet to Bob. Okay. So now if Bob decrypts this message, okay, the message will say I am Alice. So Bob will assume that his intruder actually has authenticated himself or herself to the system as Alice. Okay, this is called a playback attack. So what you have done is, although you encrypted it, you can actually capture the message, store it, and replay it later, meaning send it in later. And a different person in particular can send it. Okay, then you can authenticate yourself to the system. Okay, is this clear? What is the problem with this protocol? It is called playback attacks. So what do we do? And what is the solution then? I mean, you tried encryption, doesn't work. If it, okay. Okay, so timestamp. So issue is, there has to be a way to, I mean, you can use this protocol, but there has to be a way to prevent playback attacks from happening. Okay. And the way to do this is to ensure that if this packet is reused any time in the future, it will be flagged as invalid by Bob. Okay. So how do you do this? Okay. So there was a suggestion saying let's use a timestamp. So the general notion of doing this is you use what is called a nonce. Okay. So nonce is what's a nonce? So nonce is basically a once in a lifetime number. It's an integer. Okay. And it is something that you will pick once in a lifetime. Okay. I mean, every time you pick a nonce, the presumption is you will pick a different one. You will never pick a number that you already picked before. Okay. So in this case, so here's the protocol. So Alice is going to send a message to Bob saying, I'm Alice. This goes as plain text. Okay. No encryption yet. Okay. Bob is then going to generate a once in a lifetime integer n and send that back to Alice saying, this is called a challenge. Okay, so this challenge is essentially an integer. Say, here is an integer. If you are really Alice, then now take this integer, encrypt it, and send it back to me. Okay? So Alice will then take the secret key that only she and Bob knows and encrypt the nonce, once in a lifetime nonce that was sent, and send it in. And then Bob is going to decrypt it. Okay? And if you actually extract the nonce that was sent originally, then you know that you can authenticate Alice. Now the reason you cannot do replay attacks here is we will assume that once you have chosen this nonce, any future attempts by Alice to authenticate to Bob will always result in a different nonce, never the same nonce. Okay. So if an intruder comes along and presents this encrypted message, that doesn't make sense to Bob because you would never pick that nonce again. Once you have picked it, you are done. So this is, so what you have essentially done is equivalent of one-time password. So every time essentially your password or the secret that you are presenting to the system to authenticate keeps changing. So once you use something, you will never reuse it. So if somebody actually captures your encrypted nonce, which is your encrypted password in this case, you will never be able to use it again. Yeah, so if you basically ensure that the secret you are using for authentication keeps changing every time, then you are done. Okay. Now there is an issue of how do you pick a nonce that is once in a lifetime. So you have to pick an integer that is very large, so you will never have to have a wraparound. So regardless of how many times Alice authenticates, you can always pick a new one. Okay. It could be simple incrementing an integer, so long as the integer never wraps around. Okay. That's fine. You always start with 0. Next time, unless authenticate, use a 1 and 2 and 3. But you shouldn't have to basically, since all integers on real machines are finite bit integers, eventually there is going to be a wraparound. So you want to ensure that you use your 64-bit or 128-bit integers so that in the lifetime of this application, you will never have to actually wrap around and restart with 0. That's the point. Okay. Is this clear? So, yes, you have a question.
Yes, question
is, do you have to keep track of all nonces? So nonces, you don't have to make nonce a random number. You can, as I said, just pick an integer that keeps incrementing by one every time. Because all you need to guarantee is that it is not going to be reused. Okay? Okay, so you just start from zero. So for every user, you have an integer, and you know how many you have. Just keep track of that counter, essentially. Next time you try, somebody tries to log in or authenticate, you just increment it by one and issue that nonce. Okay? If you are picking randomly, then you will have to keep track. Okay? But just by incrementing it sequentially, it's trivial to keep track. Okay? Because it's not an issue of can you guess it, because it's actually going unencrypted over the network. So you may as well send sequential integers. The issue is that because this is being encrypted by a secret key that's only known to Alice, only Alice can do something with this nonce. Even if the nonce is captured by some intruder, they can't do anything. They cannot actually present this message, which is the encrypted version of the nonce. Okay. Any questions here? Is this clear? Okay, so now we will show how to do the same thing with public key. That was a symmetric encryption algorithm that we looked at last time. The same thing can be done using public key cryptography. Okay. So this is the protocol. Okay, this is, so Alice sends a message to Bob saying, I'm Alice. Okay. So Bob is going to now send a nonce back. Okay, here in this protocol, because it's public key cryptography, there is no reason to decide a priori on a key. In the previous protocol, you have to decide on a symmetric key ahead of time. So there's the problem of how do you decide that key in a secure way. Okay? Here you don't need to do that. Okay? All you do is you use your public key. So then what happens is Alice, once you get the nonce, Alice uses her private key to encrypt the nonce. Okay? And she sends that nonce to Bob. Okay? And Alice's public key is known to everyone. Okay? That's the assumption in public key cryptography. Your public key is known to everyone. Your private key is only known to you. So you take the nonce, you sign it with your private key, and since your private key is only known to you, only you can generate the encrypted version of the nonce using your private key. Okay? But anyone can check that this encrypted message was generated by Alice. In particular, Bob can check using Alice's public key, you decrypt the message. Okay? And then if you get back the nonce, you are guaranteed that this encrypted message actually came from Alice. Because the private key is only known to Alice. Only Alice could have produced this encrypted version of the nonce. Yeah, and since the public key is known, okay, Bob can just take Alice's public key and check that only Alice could have generated this. Okay. Again, this is called a challenge response system. Okay. This nonce, which is your once in a lifetime thing, is a challenge that you respond. So if you are Alice, here is a challenge. Prove to me that you are Alice. So you take this challenge, you encrypt it with your public key, or rather your private key, and send it in. Okay? And then your public key is used to verify that only you could have sent this message. Any questions on this?
Are there any attacks possible on 4.0 or 5.0?
Okay, so are there any attacks possible on 4.0 and 5.0? So if you go back to the last class, I said there is one problem with any encryption algorithm, no matter how strong, and that has to do with key distribution. Okay, all encryption algorithms, or in this case authentication algorithms, are only as strong as the key distribution mechanism. If you don't have a secure way to distribute keys, you are going to be vulnerable to attacks. Okay, so in particular here, once Alice has actually sent the encrypted, Bob has to get hold of Alice's public key. Okay? If that mechanism is broken, and we haven't said how you do that, that's done using key distribution. If that mechanism has a problem, then you will have a trouble. Okay? So in particular, so Trudy might be masquerading as Alice and send a message saying, I'm Alice. Okay? So your challenge is sent saying, here is a nonce. Okay? Then Trudy can take her private key, not Alice's private key. Alice's private key is secret. Trudy can take her private key. Okay, and then send back a response saying, here is my private key. Now when Bob goes to get Alice's private key, Trudy can intercept that message and send her public key instead of Alice's public. So if your key distribution is broken, meaning you are not getting the right public key, okay, then you are vulnerable to this attack, because you will take the wrong public key and authenticate Trudy as Alice. Okay, so that's actually being shown on the next slide here. So this is the same problem that I was mentioning. So 2D sends a message to Bob saying, I'm Alice. You are masquerading as someone else. Bob sends a message to Alice saying, here is a nonce, which 2D intercepts. Okay, so 2D got hold of the nonce. They send in plain text, so you can get that. 2D sends a message to Bob saying, here is the encrypted version of the nonce. It is sent signed with 2D's private key, not Alice's private key. Okay. Bob sends a message to Alice saying, send me your public key. Okay. Typically, you don't send this message, but you get the public key from somewhere. As I said, you might post your public key on your web page, for instance. Okay. So, if you try to get that public key, the message, either you can hack into somebody's website and change the public key, or the message that's coming over HTTP may be unencrypted, so you may switch the public key. So when Trudy, Bob sends this request saying, send me your public key, you may send the wrong key. Okay? In particular, Trudy can send her own public key claiming that it is Alice's public key. Okay? So then what Bob is going to do is he's going to use the wrong key and decrypt the message and get back the norm and assume that that's actually Alice, although it's Trudy and you are. So this is, as I mentioned, called man-in-the-middle attack, where there's an intruder sitting in between. And the reason this is the problem arises is not because there's anything wrong with the encryption algorithm. The problem is there is something wrong with the key distribution. So you are not able to get the key in a secure way. Same thing is going to be true of 4.0. Okay? You have to basically pick this symmetric key ahead of time. Okay? If this is not done in a secure way, if somebody gets hold of this symmetric key while you are distributing it, then they can also masquerade as Alice. Okay, so key distribution is crucial to ensure that authentication works. Okay, that's question.
If you're sending the nonce in plaintext, isn't that a problem? Couldn't they look at the plaintext nonce and then the reply that comes back to Alice and someone in the middle, I mean, and then somehow figure out the encryption based on that? I mean, now you know what the encrypted message is supposed to say.
Yeah, so this is, so you're saying you have a nonce, you have the encrypted version of the nonce. Okay. So can you figure something out? Okay. So as we talked about last time, the encryption algorithms, a good encryption algorithms are ones where given a message and the encrypted version of the message, you shouldn't be able to figure out what is the key. If given this and this, you can figure out the key, then that's not a good encryption algorithm. The encryption algorithm should not be vulnerable to brute force attacks. We talked about that as well. You shouldn't be able to generate all possible keys, okay, 0 to n, and then try whether if I use this key and I encrypt, and do I get this? If I use the other key and encrypt, then do I get this? If you do that, then also you can guess the key. Okay. So if your encryption algorithm is robust to such attacks, which RSA is, because I said, I mean, the principle behind that is you use very large primes, and factoring primes is not computationally tractable. Okay, it takes an order of thousands or millions of years if you take really large primes to factor it. So you are not vulnerable to these kinds of attacks, even though you know a message and its encrypted version. Okay? That's a fundamental property of an encryption algorithm. You will only flag that algorithm as good if it is not vulnerable to these attacks. So we are assuming that that's already done for us. So then you don't have an issue. Any question here? Okay. So as I mentioned last time, which is the same thing that I'm sort of re-emphasizing here, any authentication protocol or encryption algorithm is only as secure as the key distribution mechanism. So this has to be done in a good way. This is just a picture that shows the same attack. So now we'll talk about key distribution momentarily, but I want to first talk about one more thing, which is digital signature. Okay? The same authentication protocol that we just looked at, okay, can also be used to digitally sign messages. Okay? So where are digital signature used? So you can actually use this notion of a digital signature as a replacement for your physical signature. So if you have, let's say, electronic contract, you can sign this digitally, just as you sign a piece of paper or you sign a check. You have the same notion in the digital world. Okay? And the issue is, if you sign something, okay, then somebody can verify that you signed it and only you signed it, and you cannot deny that you signed it. So if you basically sign a check and you present that to your bank, the bank can actually verify that you signed it because they have your signature on file. Okay? And you cannot go later on and claim that you didn't sign it because they have proof saying here is your signature. Okay. The assumption, of course, is your signature is not easily forgeable. Okay, so if you take that as a given, then physical signatures give you this property. Somebody can verify that you signed it and you cannot deny having signed it because they have proof that you signed it. We want the same property in digital signatures. Okay. So basically want a sender, so you cannot repudiate that the message was never sent. So you can basically cannot do that, and somebody else shouldn't be able to fake your signature. Okay. Now very simply you can do this by using public key cryptography. Okay. Since your private key is only known to you, okay, you can take any arbitrary message or a document. A document can be thought of a string, essentially a long string, and you can sign the, encrypt that with your private key. Okay. And you hand over this encrypted version of a message or a document to someone. Okay. Now what can somebody do with this? So suppose it's a document, it's a contract you want to sign. Okay, you basically take your private key and you take that document and you encrypt it with your private key and you say, here, this is my signed copy of the contract. Okay. So what can the recipient do? The recipient can check that you signed it, because your public key is known. They can take your public key and decrypt this thing and the original document appears. Okay. So that verifies that only you could have encrypted it, because your private key is only known to you. Okay, so I can verify that you signed this message. Second, you cannot claim that you did not sign it. If your public key is indeed secret and only known to you, only you could have produced this encrypted version. Okay? No one else can arbitrarily generate this encrypted version, because they don't know your private key. Okay? So just using your private key to encrypt any message is also equivalent to signing that message, is equivalent to attaching your digital signature on this message. Because somebody can verify that only you could have generated this encrypted version using a public key which is widely known. So it's trivial to verify. If your public key is known, somebody can get the public key and check. Just decrypt this and know that your message is actually signed by you, and you cannot deny signing it, the message. Okay. So very simply, the authentication protocol or public key cryptography can also be used for digital signature, and it is indeed used by in electronic contracts and so on. You actually use this same protocol to sign documents and other packets and whatnot. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So now this is the basic protocol, which says you take any arbitrary document or message and you encrypt it with your public key. Okay. Now it so happens that if this message is very long, okay, or the document, let's say, is 100 pages. Okay. It is computationally expensive to then take your private key and encrypt the whole thing. Okay. This public key cryptography is expensive to do. The keys are very long, okay, 248 bits long, for instance. Okay. So it is very computationally expensive when you take such long keys to encrypt the message. So the issue is, can you get the same property as the previous protocol, which is very simple, without having to pay a very high cost? Okay. And the way this is done is using this notion of a message digest. Okay. So what you now do is, you're given a document or a message that you want to sign, okay, which could be of arbitrary length. You first apply a hash function to compute a fixed length string, fixed length hash of this message. Okay. And then you sign that hash rather than signing the original message, meaning you take that hash and you encrypt it with your private key. And then you present the original document and the signed hash as proof that you signed this message. Okay. Again, the same property holds. Because the public key is known, I can decrypt this signed message and extract the hash. Okay. And then I can take the message, and the hashing function is also well known. So I can take the message, I can recompute the hash and verify that the hash that I computed for this message matches the one that you signed. Okay. If the two match, then I know that you signed this message. Okay, if it doesn't, then you know that something has gone wrong. Okay. So this is basically, now what does this do? Because your string or message can be of arbitrary length, but hashes are always fixed length. Okay. Signing a hash is much less computationally expensive than signing an arbitrary length document. Okay. So it's much faster to do than just taking than the previous protocol. And it gives you the same property. Okay. Now the important thing here is this hashing function. Okay. Has to have certain properties. Okay. So in particular, you don't want two documents, okay, to generate the same hash value. Okay. So if you have a message M, okay, or a document M and a message M prime, if they both generate a hash value of H, okay, and let's say I signed this document Okay, so basically this is a signed value of the hash. Okay, then somebody will be able to prove that I actually signed M prime even though I only signed M. Because what I have signed is a hash of M. And if M prime also has a hash collision and generates the same hash value, somebody will then claim that I actually signed M prime, although I signed M. Okay? So you don't want this property. Right? In other words, you don't want collisions. You want a good hash function that says that it is very, the probability of two documents mapping onto the same hash value is very small. Okay? It cannot be zero. Okay, because a hash is actually a smaller bit string. So if you take arbitrary length string, some strings are actually going to collide. Okay, but you want that probability to be as small as possible. Okay. So you are given a digest X, it should be infeasible to find another message or another document that generates the same hash. Okay. And then basically you don't want two messages to basically match. So in other words, given a hash value, you shouldn't be able to generate a document which will map to that. Okay, then you can do forgery. Or given two documents, you should have very low probability that they will collide. Okay? So you want, if you have a hashing function that meets these two properties, then you can simplify the previous protocol by actually signing hashes rather than original documents. Okay? So these hashes in this terminology are called message digest. Okay? They are a short message that capture the essence of the original message. That's a digest of the original message. Yeah. And the hash function that is typically used is called MD5. Okay, so what MD5 does, and it's now known that MD5 is actually not very secure because people have found that it can collide and whatnot. So there are more sophisticated hashing functions like SHA-1 and so on, but this used to be very popular until recently. Okay. And this picture shows you how you can take arbitrary length messages. Okay, there could be megabytes, hundreds of megabytes, and always generate a 128-bit string. Yeah, that's a hash of this arbitrary length message. So every time you are only signing this 128-bit string. Okay. So what is actually done is you take this arbitrary message, you chop it up into 512-bit strings, and you basically apply the MD5 hashing function. So you compute a short version of this 512-bit string and so on. And then you take all of this and you compute something like an XOR of all of them. And so that gives you the digest for the entire message. Okay? So you chop up the arbitrary length message into fixed length messages. You apply a function and you compute a smaller bit string. Okay? So now you have number of these bit strings that represent the contents of your message. And then you compute a function which is equivalent to an XOR. And then you get your digest. Okay, that's how you do MD5. Okay. Now this does not prove to you that these two properties are true, because I haven't actually shown you what this function is. Okay, but empirically it was shown that those properties generally hold. Okay, but now you can launch brute force attacks against MD5, which is why it's not very secure to use anymore. You have to use more sophisticated hashing algorithms. Okay. Any questions on message digest and digital signatures? Okay, so now let's go back to key distribution. Okay, so that's basically the important aspect that you have to take care of. And this is where distributed systems come in. Because until now, encryption algorithms are just algorithms. Okay? The real implementation issues come up when you implement key distribution in a secure way. So we'll start with two types of techniques, one that uses symmetric keys and the one that uses asymmetric or public keys. Okay, so let me show you a protocol that does it. So here is a very simple key distribution mechanism. Okay. So let's say Alice wants to communicate with Bob, okay, and you want a session key. Okay, a session key is a symmetric key that is only valid for this session of communication between Alice and Bob. So the idea is for every communication session, you will actually generate a new key. So keys are not going to be reused. Okay? And your key distribution center, which is called a KDC, is going to generate keys for you as needed. And every time you want to communicate, it will generate a different key. Okay? So you don't have playback attacks and whatnot. Okay? So how do you get this one-time session key, which we'll call key that is used between Alice and Bob? KAB is this one-time session key. So Alice sends a message to the KDC saying, I'm Alice. I want to communicate with Bob, generate a one-time session key. Yes, that will use symmetric encryption algorithm. So the KDC will generate some key, and it's assumed that it's a one-time key, and it will encrypt it with another key that only Alice and the KDC know. KADC is a secret key. It's only known to Alice and KDC. Okay, this is, has to be decided ahead of time what this key is. Okay, so then this key arrives at here, and the Alice, since Alice knows this key, she can extract the session key from this. Okay, and then the KDC is going to send the same session key to Bob, but this time it's encrypted with a key that is only known to Bob and the KDC. Okay. So the assumption here is, when you set up your machines initially, when you install the OS, you have to generate a one-time key, not a one-time, rather a secret key that is only known to you, your machine, or you and the key distribution center. And that is what you are going to use to communicate with the KDC. If that is in place, then you can ask the KDC to generate a one-time session key, and it comes to you encrypted with your, the key that only you and the KDC know. So every pair that, of machine and the KDC will have a separate key, and that's what you will, the KDC will use to communicate with. Okay? It's a very trivial protocol that shows how some trusted third party is generating your encryption keys for you, okay, and is communicating them with you in a secure fashion. And the assumption here is this message, which is the key, cannot be intercepted by someone because it's encrypted. It's only encrypted with a key that only the KDC and you know. And that has to be decided ahead of time. Here is another version of the same protocol. In this case, you basically say, I'm Alice, I want to communicate with Bob. So the KDC generates the session key KAB, and he sends the encrypted version that is encrypted with Alice and KDC's key, as well as the one that needs to be sent to Bob. Both are sent to Alice. Okay? Alice extracts this key, okay, and then sends off a message, sends off this key, saying, I'm Alice, here's the key you should use to communicate with me. Okay? This part of the message, Alice cannot decrypt because it's signed with or encrypted with a key that only Bob and the KDC know. All you can do is take that encrypted message and just transmit it to Bob. Okay. So here, Alice actually initiates the connection. In the previous case, Bob suddenly gets a key from the KDC, saying, here is the key. Okay. So rather than doing that, if you want Alice to initiate the communication and transmit the key to you, you use this variant of the protocol. It's doing the same thing, except that the message to start communication or set up a channel comes from Alice with the key. Any questions on this? Okay, so here is a version of this protocol that uses nonsense. Okay? Same idea, but now you want to generate a nonce to prevent additional replay attack. This is called a Needham-Schroeder protocol. It's widely used in practice. Okay, so although this looks complicated, it's really very simple. The same protocol that we used before is used, except that there are nonces being generated to prevent replay attack of the session keys. Okay, so here, Alice picks a once in a lifetime integer, okay, which is called RA1, and sends that to the KDC saying, I'm Alice, I want to communicate with Bob, here is a nonce. Okay. So then the KDC generates a one-time session key, okay, which is KAB. Okay. So it sends back the nonce, says, okay, you want to communicate with Bob, this is the nonce that you sent. Okay. So then you know only the KDC is communicating with you, not someone else, because you generated this nonce. Then says, here is the key you are going to use to talk to Bob, and here is the how you send this key also to Bob, because Bob doesn't know that key yet. Okay, this is the encrypted version that only the Bob and KDC knows, and this whole message is encrypted with the key that only Alice and KDC know. So this can be decrypted only by Alice. So the nonce comes back, the key comes back, and the encrypted version of the key that you are supposed to send to Bob comes back. Okay? And so now Alice generates a second nonce, okay, encrypts it with the session key. Saying, I want to start a session, here is another nonce, and here is the key you are supposed to use. Okay? So that goes back to Bob. Bob can extract this key, because you know the key between K and A, so you can decrypt it and extract the session key. And then you take the nonce that was sent to you, you send it back. Okay, you send nonce minus one, send a new nonce back to Alice, say, okay, I got your nonce, here is another nonce. Okay? So it goes back and then you send back the nonce back to ensure that there is no replay attacks. Okay, so you are using nonces at each step to ensure that none of those messages can be replayed. That's the basic point. Okay? Same idea as the previous one, but with a notion of a nonce to avoid any replay type scenarios. Any questions on this? Okay, so here is a very simple protocol that does not use a K distribution mechanism, but still requires that public keys be distributed securely. Okay. So this is called mutual authentication. Alice is just proving to Bob that she is Alice, and Bob is going to prove to Alice that he is Bob. So you basically say, I am Alice, here is a nonce. Okay. And then you sign it with Bob's public key and you send it over. Okay. Bob's public key is known, so anyone can generate a nonce, claim that they are Alice. Okay. So now Bob is going to send that nonce back, decrypt this, send the nonce back, generate a new nonce and generate a session key, and send that back. And it is encrypted with Alice's public key. So only Alice can decrypt it, because you need the private key to decrypt this message. Okay. So only Alice can decrypt this, extract the nonce and send it back with the session key, saying, okay, I got your message, I'm encrypting this message with session key, and you send it back. Okay. So you are basically signing messages with your public keys and ensuring that only the person you are sending it to can decrypt it. So that automatically does mutual authentication. If I send you a message that only you can decrypt and you send a version of that message back to me, I know that only you could have done this, no one else. Okay, that's the basic idea here. Any questions on this? Okay, so now we'll come back to public key cryptography. I mentioned that this is vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attack, because if you post your public key on a web page or some unsecure medium, somebody can get hold of it, yeah, or modify it and let someone else pick a wrong version of the key. So how do you get around this? Okay. So then the issue is you need a key distribution mechanism. Okay. So rather than posting this publicly, you have a trusted server that everyone trusts. Okay. And that actually has a repository of everyone's public key. So you generate a public key, you actually give it to the server saying, if anyone asks, then you should supply it. No, I'm not going to put it on a unsecure mechanism. And so that's one thing. All public keys reside at a trusted server. Okay. And it is assumed that the public key of the trusted server itself is well known. Okay, because you will communicate with the trusted server using the trusted server's public key. And that's well known. Then you can ask the question, how do you know it's well known? I mean, how do you get hold of it? So you can use some well known dissemination mechanism to do it. For instance, you publish it in the newspaper. Okay, so you can go and get it from the newspaper or publish it in a place that is widely disseminated and everybody gets it and you cannot forge it later or sort of supply an incorrect one. So if you assume it's what you do, for instance, when you get a browser, okay, the public key is already embedded in the browser. Okay, there are trusted entities and the public key, the developer has actually gotten and embedded in it. Assume that you trust it. Okay. So if you now indeed trust this server and you have the server's public key, then I can get anyone's public key by just asking the server. So I can go to the trusted server and say, give me, Alice can go and say, give me Bob's public key. Okay. And you basically encrypt this message with your own key. So I'm Alice, give me Bob's public key. And then the server is going to actually give you Bob's public key. And then you can use that public key. Okay, is that clear? What the basic idea is. So rather than using unsecure methods to get public keys, you put all of them in a trusted server. Okay? And you know the public key of the trusted server, and you use that public key to encrypt messages, and then the trusted server will actually send someone's public key encrypted with the private key of the server. So you know that only the server could have sent it. So, in other words, the key is signed by the trusted server. Okay, so you can verify that only the trusted server could have sent it because you are the server's public key. Okay. Any questions here? Sorry, what is the question? Yes. So this is the first message. So maybe I didn't go through the protocol carefully. So you say give me Bob's key and you encrypt this message with the public key of the server. Okay. So first of all, nobody will know whose key you are requesting, because it is encrypted with the server. Only the server can decrypt this message. So an intruder in particular doesn't even know by looking at this message whose key you are requested, because you have encrypted it with a public key. I don't know. Okay. Only the trusted server can extract this message and say, oh, you are asking for Bob's public key. So you take Bob's public key, okay, and you also know Alice's public key, because everyone's public key is here. You take Bob's public key and you encrypt it with Alice's public key and say, here it is. Okay. So this message only Alice can decrypt, because the private key is only known to Alice. Server has to add the private key. No, if the you can sign this additionally if you want to. Here there is no signature needed. Because all you are doing is you are sending a public key with, yes, so if you want to additionally figure out you are talking to the server, that's the authentication step. You can authenticate before you do this communication, so you know that you are talking to the server and no one else. Okay? This is not showing you authentication, it is only showing you once you have authenticated, how do you get it. Okay? So you are getting the public key of Bob, it is signed with your own public key, so only you can extract this. That's the basic assumption. Okay? Any other questions on this? Now that's a good point. I mean, it hasn't shown the authentication step here. So you need to know you are talking to the server, otherwise this doesn't work. Yes? True. So I mean, you basically, so here, but here is the problem, that why you need authentication. That's a good point. So you sent saying I want Bob's public key, you encrypted it. Okay? Now some intruder can get hold of this message. And all that the intruder knows is you are requesting someone's public key. You don't know whose public key. Okay. So now what you can do is masquerade as a trusted server and send some arbitrary public key here. And since you know Alice's public key, you can sign this message. So you can encrypt it with Alice's public key and send 2D's public key instead. Okay. So if you don't authenticate with the server, you have to know that this message has come from the server. Otherwise that's a problem, because although you don't know whose key you are requesting, you can substitute this message with somebody else's key. You can send EA with Trudy's public key. So if you haven't authenticated, you don't know that message came with it. That was the point that was just being made. That's all. Okay. Any other questions? So just to sort of make this a little more clear, the trusted server is often called a certification authority. Okay, so if you actually go into your browser, you will see that there are certain certification authorities that are trusted, like VeriSign and some companies that are known in the business of issuing keys and certificates. Okay, their public key is known to everyone. Okay, so the way they actually issue public keys is they actually sign the public key with their own, sign the keys with their own key, so you know that it came from the server. Okay. A certificate is a key that is signed by the trusted party. So you know that the trusted party actually sent this key. And you can verify that the trusted party sent this key. Yes. Correct. So that's a good point. So in many systems, like if you do HTTPS, right, so you're talking to a web server on a secure channel. Okay? Typically, you don't go to this trusted server on the fly and say, oh, give me the public key of this other server. So suppose you want to go to Amazon to buy something and you want to have a secure connection, HTTPS connection. You don't go to a trusted server and say, give me Amazon's public key. Okay? You just go to Amazon and say, give me your public key. So what Amazon has done is Amazon has already taken the public key that is signed by a trusted third party. Okay? And you present this public key to the client, say, here is my public key, it's signed by this trusted entity. So if you trust that entity, you can verify that it's signed. You use the same digital signature that I showed you previously. So So certificate is essentially a public key that's signed by a trusted party that you can just present to someone. So here is my certificate with my public key in it. So you verify that this public key was signed by someone. So now you trust this public key that nobody can send you some garbage. You know only this trusted entity could have issued this certificate. That's what is done. So in reality, this step is doesn't actually happen. You take the public, you sign it, and you just present it. So Alice directly goes to Bob. Bob has the public key here that's signed. Okay, then if you present a signed version of the public key, that's different from just posting an unencrypted version of the public key. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so let me just skip this. I'll talk about just 1 second. So I just want to show. Let's see. So different systems store this in different places. So if you want to see all the public keys, so these are all the certificates. So here are all the certificates. So you can see various certificates that have been presented to your machine when you communicate. So this is a root certificate. These are trusted parties. This is a very signed certificate. So this comes to you in the machine. So you can look at it. So it is actually encrypted with SHA-1 and whatnot. So that's a certificate. Now someone else can get a certificate that is issued by VeriSign and send it to you. So that's a certificate that VeriSign has signed using their own public key, which is well known. So let's look at some examples. So these are trusted certificates. And then so these are all root level trusted certificates. So where are the real ones? System certificate. Okay, so it's the same. Okay, so here are all the certificates. So this is a personal certificate that I have. So this is now signed by some certification authority. So I can go with this certificate and say I am such and such. It's signed by someone. Okay, so now you can actually check against the trusted server that I am claiming to be Prashant Shenoy and not someone else. Okay, using this mechanism. So rather than going to the trusted server, I present my public key, which is a signed version of the public key. It's called a certificate. This is what I can present. A server can present the same kind of credentials to you. Okay, this is what happens when you set up an SSL or a HTTPS connection. Okay, just as an example. So in Firefox, this is stored in a different place. So you have to actually go and look at, in security. And it keeps moving. It's not exceptions. Okay, so here are the certificates. So these are all the certificates that it trusts. So here is a trusted authority somewhere else. So if any of these sign a certificate and present to you, Firefox will accept it. That says these are the trusted authorities. These are the servers that it knows about. So here is www.cs.umass.edu. It presented a certificate that was signed and it stored that certificate as well. Okay, so these are servers that use certificates signed by someone else to present it. So these are people. There's some email here. So you can have these kind of certificates. So these are public keys that are signed by trusted entities. Okay, so let's come back to access control. So that's basically authentication. Okay, now we are going to look at, I just have one slide on access control. Okay, so now assume that you have already done some sort of authentication. You prove to the system who you are. Okay, that gives you certain privileges. Okay, there are certain things you can do as you, the user, and certain things you may not be able to do. In particular, administrative or privileged operations, you may not have rights to do. So after authentication, when you issue some command or ask the system to take some action, the system still has to check. Okay, it knows that the command, the request is coming from you, but it doesn't know whether you have sufficient privileges to do this. Okay, and this is typically handled through access control. And there are three ways to do this. There is something called an access control list, something called capabilities, something called protection domains. Okay, three sort of equivalent ways to exactly the same thing. In an access control list, you do these checks on who can do what with respect to the object or the data item. Okay? So the file may have a list of people who can access it. Okay? In Unix, you have read, write, execute bits that are associated with user, group, and world. Okay? That's an access control list, so that the rights of who has access to it is stored with the data item. Okay? This is called an access control list. Okay? If the rights are actually user-centric, which means the user actually has a certificate that says here are all the things I am pre-authorized to do, and I present this to the system. Okay? So system, there are, you don't have rights that are associated with files, but before I access the file, I have to prove to the system that I have access to the file. Okay? This is done using what is called a capability. Okay? Capability is simply a certificate saying I have such and such rights on this system. Okay. So system just verifies, okay, you have this right, so now you can go ahead and access, so you can verify. Okay. So you have two types of access control. One is data centric, where you store who has rights to access it with files. Another one is user centric, where you don't have your data specific list, you have user specific list. So these users can do the same. They are equivalent in some sense. Okay. On most systems, you will see ACL based access control, okay, because you associate rights with objects, not with users. Okay, and users belong to certain groups or domains that allow you or don't allow you this right. Whether you are part of the admin group or some other group tells you what you can do. Okay? But there are systems that use capabilities also. They are not as common as the ones that use access control lists or protection bits and whatnot. Okay? The last one is actually what's called protection domains, where you have a hierarchy. And you can belong to different parts of the hierarchy, and that gives you certain privileges. So these are groups that you can form. So you could be part of an employee group within an organization, or you could be an anonymous user. Within the employee group, you may have, let's say, administrators, you may have staff, you may have students, if this is a university, and that may give you different privileges, yeah, on what files you can access, which machines you can log into, and so on and so forth. So you use these protection domains also to specify certain user-specific rights. So there are multiple ways to do this. In this class, I'm not going to go into any details of how you can implement ACLs or capabilities. I just wanted to mention this here, okay, because that's one part of the story that we will not look at in detail. Okay? So we have looked at authentication, we have looked at encryption. So now we are going to look at a sequence of applications that actually put this in practice. Okay, so we look at firewalls, we look at how to do secure email, we look at distributed authentication like Kerberos and so on. Okay, very quick case studies on a variety of applications. Okay, the first one is firewall. Okay, so this is typically used to protect a network from intruders. Okay, so essentially what it is it's a box or a machine that sits between an external network, typically the internet, and an internal network, which is a LAN. Okay? All packets that basically cross this boundary have to go through this machine, so called a firewall. And the firewall has a set of rules that tell it what packets are allowed and what packets are not allowed. Okay? And you can set these rules to decide what sort of communication is permitted between the internal network and the external world. Okay, and what is not. So this could be rules that are specific to ports. So for instance, you can say all traffic on port 80 should be let in. If you have a HTTP server running, any traffic that has port 80 just goes through the firewall. Okay? Or you could say block SSH connections. So you can basically block port 22. So when somebody tries to make a connection, SSH connection to machine on this side of the firewall on port 22, the firewall will block it. Okay? So you can have arbitrary rules. It could say anything like you can actually examine the contents of a packet and say if this string is present in the packet, then don't send this packet. This is typically done for security. You can do scanning of packets to see if there are viruses that are being transmitted. because we can actually do everything from look at packet headers and look up some rules to actually look at the packet contents and figure out what to do. Okay, so essentially this is a filter that figures out which packets get to go and which packets don't are not allowed. Okay. And the way you configure this filter is what actually determines how secure a network is. If you let all traffic in and out, then essentially there's no security. Okay. But in most cases, there will be some rules that the organization imposes on what is allowed and what's not allowed. Okay, so you will see that there are two filters here. One is outgoing and one is incoming. Okay. In most cases, the firewall actually protects the internal network from the outside traffic, but essentially firewalls are bidirectional. You can have any rules on the inside as well. So if you say when employees are not allowed to browse the web during normal business hours, the firewall can actually stop outgoing HTTP traffic. Yes, it's basically the same, just a rule that decides which packets get to go out and your rules that decide which packets get to come in. Yes, so you can have any rules that you want in these firewalls. Okay, so if you are actually looking at application specific content, then you also have a gateway in this. Otherwise you just have rules that look at headers. Okay, but as I said, the rules can be arbitrary, determines what's happening. So that's one example of how you can implement network security. You deploy these machines called firewalls that do this. Second case study is how to do secure email. Okay, this is going to use a lot of the concepts that we talked about, authentication, message digest, digital signatures, all in one. Okay, so what are the requirements? If you want to implement a secure email system, what do you want? Okay, you want secrecy, which says if I'm sending a mail to someone, only that person should be able to read it, nobody else. You may want sender authentication, saying if I send you a message, can you verify that the message came from me and not somebody else who is sending you spam masquerading as me. You want authentication. You want message integrity. Then message integrity means if I send you a message, nobody has altered this message in transit. Okay, so if somebody changes the contents of the message, you should be able to detect that. Okay, and you want receiver authentication, which means only the receiver can read this message, nobody else. Yes, we want all of these properties. So let's take each at a time. So let's just do how to do secrecy. Okay. Secrecy, that should be simple. All you have to do is encrypt the message. Okay. So if you use public key cryptography, and so if Alice wants to send a message to Bob, you get Bob's public key, you take an email message and you encrypt it with Bob's public key. Okay. This is going to ensure secrecy because the private key is only known to Bob. So this encrypted message is essentially useless to anyone else. They can't do anything, can't read this message. Okay. Now, when we did digital signatures, I mentioned that just using public key cryptography can be very expensive. Okay, because these keys are long and encrypting arbitrary length messages can be computationally expensive. So what you do really is you actually generate a symmetry key. Okay, and you encrypt the message with this symmetry key and you encode the symmetry key itself, encrypt the symmetry key itself with Bob's public key. Okay. This ensures that this key can be only extracted by Bob, and once you get the key, then you can decrypt the message. Okay. So without this key K, no one else can decrypt it, and the key is actually sent encrypted with Bob's public key. So you are using public key cryptography, but you are not encrypting M, we are encrypting the key that is actually used to encrypt M. Okay. This will be cheaper if this key is smaller than the public key, which typically it is. Okay. So this will only give you secrecy. I mean, the secrecy just says encrypt your email messages and nobody else can read it. Yeah, that's very simple. So now how do you do sender authentication, message integrity? Yes, so we'll talk about that's coming. So message digest is here. Message digest is not going to give you encryption. You can do integrity check.
Message digest
yeah. Correct. But that will not give you secrecy. It will only ensure message integrity. Because if you do computer digest, the message itself is sent unencrypted. Okay. So you want all of those. So we are looking at how to do each step and then we'll put it together. So next we can do authentication and integrity, but no secrecy. Okay, so you will get authentication, which means you will verify that somebody has sent you the message, and you can verify that nobody altered this message in transit. So what you do is you compute a hash of the message, which is a message digest as I just mentioned. Okay, so you take message M, you apply MD5 or some hashing function, you compute H, okay, which is a hash of this. Okay. Then what you do is you basically, Alice will sign this hash, okay, with her private key. Okay. So then you basically send the message which is unencrypted and this signature with it. So with the signature you can do two things. Because it is a digital signature, okay, you can verify that only Alice has sent this, because you can use Alice's public key, extract the hash, take the message, compute the hash and compare them. If they match, you know Alice actually signed this message. Okay. That message digest also ensures message integrity, because if anyone modifies this message M and sends M prime instead, okay, you know that the message has changed, because the hash of M prime will not match what has the hash that has been signed. Okay, so in one step, by just taking a hash and digitally signing the hash with your private key, you achieve two things. You achieve authentication, because you can verify that from the signature that Alice actually sent this message, because it's signed by Alice. Okay? And second, you can also ensure that nobody changed the message. Okay, because the message changes, it hash changes. So what is signed is a different hash, so you know that this is not the message that was sent by Alice. Somebody has modified it. Okay. So now this is giving authentication and integrity, but message is going unencrypted, so there's no secrecy. In the previous case, you have secrecy, but you don't get authentication and integrity. So if you take these two techniques and put it together, then you will get the secure email that you really want. Okay. So what happens in this case, you get M. Okay. You then basically compute a hash of M and you sign it, and that gives you a digital signature that guarantees authentication and integrity. And then you do what is done in the previous step. You compute a symmetric key K, okay, and then you take the actual message M and the hash of M. So that should be M and not H of M. Okay, so then you basically take the message, the signature, generate a symmetric key and you sign, encrypt the whole thing. So the message and the signature actually go encrypted. Okay. And then you take the key itself and you encrypt it with Bob's public key. So what comes to Bob is an encrypted message and a key that is basically encrypted using the public key. So you can extract the key, you can extract K. Once you have extracted K, then you can extract M prime. Once you have extracted M prime, you have the message and a signature. You can verify that this was signed by Alice and it hasn't been changed. Okay, so you basically get all of the properties you want. Okay, so many systems like PGP, which is pretty good privacy, and there's an implementation called GPG, which is GNU's implementation of PGP, essentially use this technique. Okay, if you want, you can actually encrypt all your emails and only ensure that the other person can view it. Okay, so this is an application that puts these concepts we have been talking about, encryption, authentication, digest, signatures, into one system. Okay, here's another application, which is SSL. Okay, this is the process that is used to set up an HTTP connection, HTTPS connection rather, with a server. Okay, so if you want to do any transactions, if you log into your online banking or you go to Amazon or you go to eBay, you basically use a secure connection between the browser and the server. Okay? The secure connection is established using something called a secure socket. Okay? This is a socket connection, but everything that is going on the socket connection is encrypted. It's like socket, but you basically send text. When you do send and you just give text, the socket library will encrypt it and send the encrypted version. Okay, at the other end, you decrypt it and get the original version. So the question is, how do you do this? So this is basically the protocol. Okay, so the browser basically sends a message to the server saying, I want to set up a secure connection, and this is the SSL version I support. SSL, let's say version 2 or version 3. Okay. So the server sends back a message to the browser saying, I can support also, let's say, SSL version 2, and here is my certificate. Okay, the certificate will establish that I am this server that I'm claiming to be. Okay. So now what the certificate is, essentially the server's public key encrypted with the trusted party's private key. Okay, so the certification authority has used the private key to sign this public key and is encrypted. Okay. So now the browser already has a list of trusted certification authorities. I just showed you in the Firefox. So and for each of those certification authority, you have their public keys already. So then you can use that public key to decrypt his message and extract the server's public key. Okay. So this ensures that the public key is coming to you securely. There's no man in the middle attack that can be launched. Okay. So the public key is extracted. Then the browser generates a session key for this session, encrypts it with the server's public key and sends it, saying let's use this session key. Okay. And then the browser says all further messages will be encrypted. Here is the session key. Okay. And the server can actually decrypt the key because it has the private key. Okay. Get the session and says, okay, all further messages will be encrypted. So at this point, your secure session is going to begin. Okay. And then if you have any modern browser, it will show you the site in green. So saying that I have authenticated and everything looks good, is secure connection. Okay. Okay, so yes, I've run out of time, so let me defer this to next time, to the Kerberos in electronic payments. Okay, so we'll talk about Kerberos and how do you use electronic cash for online payments in a secure fashion. All this, these two applications, let's defer to next week, which is a week from today. Okay, so no class on Tuesday, there's exam on Tuesday, no class, and a week from today we'll resume this discussion. Okay, so let's stop here and...